This is Jim Inkster coming today on our 4th of July show. Sam Kleiner, the author of The Flying Tigers, tells the story of American pilots who waged a secret war against Japan. Front and center is Louisiana's Claire Chenault. Also, John McGinnis, retired executive with Blue Cross Blue Shield, discusses his new endeavor as a documentary filmmaker. He's preparing to detail the story of a former leprosy patient at Carville, the home of the only American institution devoted to leprosy consulting, research, and training. Retired state employee Leslie Tossant, quite a character, is slated to be with us to reflect on a recent harrowing trip to Paris. You won't believe what happened to him. And Dr. Lee Reich on the ever-curious gardener, using a little natural science for a much better garden. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster, and our guest at this time is Sam Kleiner. He's a lawyer in New York City, raised in Arizona, BA from Northwestern University, and a doctorate in international relations from the University of Oxford, and a JD from Yale Law School. And his latest work is The Flying Tigers, the untold story of the American pilots who waged a secret war against Japan. It's a thrilling story behind the pilots who volunteered for a covert action in China before Pearl Harbor and ended up on the front lines of the war against the Japanese in the Pacific. And Sam Kleiner, these people certainly have connections to the state that I'm in, Louisiana.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me on. This is really a great Louisiana story about the commander of the Flying Tigers is Claire Chenault, who has roots all over the state, but particularly around the Lake St. Charles area. So it's a lot of great Louisiana stories packed in here.
Yes, indeed. And LSU plays a prominent role
as well.
LSU,
of course. Yes. A lot of the book starts off with talking about Claire Chenault's childhood in Louisiana, his ties to the state, and it ends in part with his homecoming parade that was held in New Orleans at the end of the war. So it's, you know, in some ways a story that first and foremost is a story of a kid from Louisiana who grows up and wants to see more of the world, and he gets the chance to shape history. And I've worked a lot with folks down at the Chenault Museum in Monroe and members of the Chenault family that have helped to color the book. So it's, you know, it's when you're speaking to people from Louisiana, Claire Chenault doesn't need much of an introduction, but just his background about the book, you know, this is about this group of American pilots who were sent over under FDR's orders even before Pearl Harbor to fight against the Japanese. And at the core of the story is Claire Chenault, who's the commander of the unit. He'd actually been over there as far back as 1937, and you know, a lot of listeners will be familiar with that famous image of the shark-faced P-40. I mean, might have seen the John Wayne movie The Flying Tigers. Yeah. You can actually see one of the planes down in the World War II Museum in New Orleans. But this is kind of the human story of who were these people and what was their story.
How did the name come about, Flying Tigers?
It's a great question. It's the toughest question you can ask. There's all different kinds of theories about, you know, where did they get the name? And Chenault himself in his memoir says, you know, I don't know. A couple theories are that, you know, the Chinese people saw them flying and thought that was, you know, that looked like they, you know, Fei Hu, they called them, you know, like they were flying tigers. I actually think it's more of a PR thing. That's the other theory, that, you know, they were originally technically called the American Volunteer Group, and they... that wasn't a good name for the newspapers, so someone came up with the name, why don't we call them the Flying Tigers, and that's what Time magazine called them in December 1941, and the name stuck.
Well, you have some great stories about Claire Chenault, and you note that in 1909 he enrolled at LSU, and of course he was involved with ROTC training, as were all other males at LSU at that time, and he was determined to live up to what was expected of a soldier, and when ordered to stand guard over a stairway, what happened?
When he was standing over the stairway, he got some guys poured water on him, but he just kind of stood there and was determined to see his shift through. So you get a lot of, you know, these kind of personal details about people. You know, he wrote a memoir in the late 1940s that, you know, is not in publication anymore, that I mined through for details, then spent a lot of time working with his family to kind of get nuggets from his life. So I have letters and his diary that has never really been used before in publications, and have worked a great amount with his family and being able to bring forward kind of new details about Chenault's life. One of my favorite things about him is, you know, he basically decided that he was going to give up everything he knew. And, you know, he had a wife and seven children in Louisiana in 1937, and he would kind of run up against his commanders in the U.S. Army, where he was a pilot, and decided that he was going to go to he had been offered the opportunity to go to China and was deciding whether or not he wanted to do that. He wrote a letter to his brother that the family kept and allowed me to use where he said, you know, this mission to China might amount to nothing, but if it goes right, it might change the course of history for hundreds of years to come. So he was clearly someone who was very interested in making history and saw himself as someone who was kind of destined to make history. And he did, because the Flying Tigers obviously played a hugely important role, and especially those opening days of World War II. And Chenaults spent 8 years of his life fighting against the Japanese from 37 to 45. And so a lot of it is about his own personal journey through that period. And he's just a remarkable mm-hmm. character, because he's really fighting against the Japanese for years before the attack on Pearl Harbor.
The book is The Flying Tigers, The Untold Story of the American Pilots Who Waged a Secret War Against Japan, from Sam Kleiner. He takes readers into the cockpits of the Tigers' iconic shark-nosed planes as they perform missions against the Japanese, destroying some 297 enemy aircraft in Burma, Thailand, and China. And you certainly make note of the fact that the Flying Tigers were revered not only as heroes in America, but also in China.
Absolutely. And so there's only one surviving Tiger left now. His name is Frank Lozanski. He lives down in Georgia. I was with him last month and was able to give him a copy of the book. And it promised him that I was going to write the accurate story of the Flying Tigers. And he's told me about when he goes back to China on these various kinds of delegations, he's swarmed in the streets with people coming up and wanting an autograph. Mm-hmm. So there's definitely a huge amount of legacy there. And I think it's important for us to also, do our job of maintaining this history, because it's so important as a link between our countries, and as you know, it's one of the great untold stories from the greatest generation. And so it's really been the privilege of my lifetime to be able to bring this story forward. My grandfather was a navigator on a B-25 in the Pacific, so there's just a huge amount of interest that I have in this period, and it's such an honor to be able to write about these great Americans.
How many of the Flying Tigers were lost in action?
There were over 20 that were killed, a few in training accidents, many in combat, and actually a few of them were shot down behind enemy lines. Part of the story is about efforts to rescue those POWs and the experience that these families had when they lost loved ones in the war as well.
And how did Chenault's life evolve after all this action?
Chenault came home to Louisiana in 1945 and thought about retiring, but really couldn't make that decision to do that yet. So he ended up moving back to China and then spent basically the rest of his life working for Chiang Kai-shek and Madame Chiang. He ultimately did retire in pieces, dividing his time between Monroe and Taipei and Taiwan. And so there's definitely a legacy that he left at the end of his life in Louisiana. He's buried in Arlington Cemetery. You can go see his grave. And on the front of it, it's in English, and in the back, it's in Chinese. It's actually the only foreign language in Arlington Cemetery. And so it kind of is symbolic of how his life ultimately was divided really between living in the U.S. and living in China. And he at one point in his diary wrote, I guess I'm Chinese, which always stood out to me when he was talking about, you know, kind of the pressures of being an American in China. And so he was someone who in some ways felt at home in both cultures, but neither was not fully accepted in either at the end.
And his wife became world famous for other reasons.
Yes, he was married a second wife, Anna Chenault, who was a much younger woman from China after the war, and she became famous in a lot of ways as a kind of famous hostess in Washington, was involved in kind of backdoor stuff in the Vietnam War. So it's a chapter that I get into at the end of the book in the epilogue. But there's so many kind of famous, interesting people that are that intersect with Chenault's life, and you get a sense of that in the book.
And you make reference to the fact that in New Orleans, when Chenault was a young man a century ago, it was the largest city in the South and one of the largest in the United States.
Absolutely, yeah. It's you know, I think it's an important point to make, you know, that Chenault was kind of coming of age at this time when there was a huge amount of interest in that region, as there still is today. And one of the first times he saw a plane fly was actually at a state fair in Louisiana, and that was, you know, one of the first times that planes had been seen really in the South. And so I think it's just a fascinating period in history of, you know, what he did and kind of the era that he came of age in.
How did you come about this? This is obviously an exhaustive book, perhaps the definitive work about the Flying Tigers. How did it happen for you, Sam?
It really was just something that I kind of grew up with my grandfather fighting in World War II in the Pacific, and I really wanted to honor this generation with telling this story. One of the first archival discoveries I had when I was working on this was when I was at Yale. I found a collection of love letters between a pilot and a nurse in the unit, and these were kind of in the basement of an archive and hadn't really been seen before. And I just knew that there was something here that I wanted to be able to delve into to tell the human side of this story.
Well, congratulations on a compelling book and one that has great relevance to the state of Louisiana. One of the Louisiana legends of all time, Claire Chenault, is front and center in The Flying Tigers, the untold story of the American pilots who waged a secret war against Japan. Thank you, Sam. And coming next is John McGinnis, recently retired executive with Blue Cross Blue Shield, on his new endeavor as a documentary filmmaker. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is your number, and happy Independence Day to you. And we're joined now by John McGinnis. He has a familiar name. Many remember another John McGinnis, who was a great political writer who died a few years ago. This John McGinnis is alive and well, recently retired with Blue Cross Blue Shield after many, many years as the top marketing person with Blue Cross, and now he is embarking on a new endeavor as a documentary filmmaker. And good morning, John McGinnis.
Good morning, Jim.
Well, tell us about what you're doing regarding telling the story of a former leprosy patient at Carville.
Yes. Well, as you know, when I was at Blue Cross, I had the opportunity to produce a number of what I call 30-second movies or television commercials over the past 25 years, and really have fallen in love with that medium. So I really fell into the opportunity to do this documentary film through a friendship with Michael Maness and the other friends in the Maness Landry families. They refer to themselves as the third generation survivors. To go back in time, they're all grandchildren of Edmund Landry. Edmund Landry was a man who, at the age of 33 in 1924, was ordered to leave his wife and two children and move to the Marine Hospital number 66, known as Carville, the only institution in the continental United States for over 90 years to treat and incarcerate patients with condition of leprosy. Mm-hmm. And so there were a number of letters that were exchanged between Edmund and his wife, Claire, throughout the 8 years that he was there. And this film is based in part upon those letters and upon a book written by Michael Maness' sister, Claire Maness, called Out of the Shadow of Leprosy. Tells the story of a secret not shared and stories suppressed for many, many years.
Well, cases of leprosy have been reported in Louisiana as early as the 18th century. The first facility in the continental United States was in Carville, 1894 to 1999, the only institution in the U.S. exclusively devoted to leprosy consulting, research, and training. This particular gentleman that you focus upon, when was he there?
He was made to go there, ordered to leave his wife and children in 1924. And he was there for 8 years before he did die.
Well, as of 2001, there were 15 total leprosy cases in Louisiana. 13 were endemic. The 13 cases came from 13 different parishes in Louisiana. The story that you're going to tell in this documentary film, John McGinnis, where does it begin?
Well, it begins in 1924, and let me set the stage a little bit here. On a fall evening in 24, Edmund and Claire Landry were receiving several members of the Knights of Columbus in New Iberia, who talked to them about the possibility of Edmund running for mayor. Edmund was a graduate of a business college in New Orleans, a veteran of World War I, a bookkeeper for a local business, and was the kind of civic-minded young man that they were looking for. That conversation went well, but Edmund's campaign never took place. Shortly after that, he received a letter from the president of the Louisiana State Board of Health, ordering him to report to Carville. He was reported to have leprosy by his physician, who was required by law to notify the Louisiana Board of Health. And so he was then made to go to Carville, where he spent the rest of his life, the last 8 years of his life.
So he lived 8 years. That's a terrible condition, isn't it?
It is a terrible condition. It's a disease of the peripheral nerves that affects the skin, because of the loss of sensation, it can result in additional damage and physical deformities. It's a disease that is communicable, but it's probably the least infectious of any communicable disease, since about 95% of our population possesses a natural immunity to it. It's not hereditary, but some people have a genetic susceptibility to the disease, and that might be inherited. It's still not known exactly how it's transmitted. It's thought to be transmitted through respiratory exchange or skin-to-skin contact. It can also possibly be contracted from the soil where the bacillus might live. Also, the armadillos are known to be carriers of the bacillus as well.
A listener notes that 10 years ago, PBS had a series, The Triumph at Carville, a film detailing the history of the facility and providing some insight into the lives of people affected, including family members, patients, staff members. This is a story that is quite individual in the one that you're going to tell. When will the finished product be available, John McGinnis?
Well, sir, it depends on our fundraising effort. Right now, we are in the fundraising phase of this project. We have been accepted we have a fiscal agent that's assisting us in this fundraising, and that is Louisiana Public Broadcasting. Through that foundation, the Foundation for Excellence in Louisiana Public Broadcasting, it's possible to make tax-deductible website is carville300.com. Mm-hmm. And on that website, you can view a four-minute, 20-second preview reel, which we shot recently. Take a look at the summary of the story, and also make a donation through the foundation or by joining our Kickstarter campaign, which all of it is detailed on the website. So that was a long way of saying it depends on the funds, but we hope to be shooting. We know we can shoot this since it's tightly scripted as much as you can script a documentary. And we can shoot this in segments. So we hope to be in the field at Carville shooting September, October of this year, if all goes well.
Well, good luck to you, and we look forward to keeping in touch as the project moves along. John McGinnis, as I noted in the introduction, a different John McGinnis than the man who wrote The Last Hayride, but I'm sure you've been confused a time or two.
Happy to be known as the other John McGinnis.
Well, both of you are fine gentlemen, and this is an important story to tell. Thank you, John McGinnis. Good to visit with you, and happy 4th.
Happy 4th to you, and thank you, Jim.
See you soon. We're about to be joined after a short break by Leslie Tossant, longtime Louisiana employee who has quite a story to tell about his recent trip to Paris. You won't believe what happened to Leslie in the great city of Paris. 877-217-5757 is your number. Talk at talklouisiana.org is our number. Ali Baltazar is producing on the 4th of July, and we return after this pause for the news with Karen Henderson. This is Jim Inkster. Pleased to have you with us for Independence Day. Your number is 877-217-5757. Ali Baltazar is producing, and our guest in studio is Leslie Tossant. 30 years he worked for the state of Louisiana, was the historic preservation officer for our state for some time. He's been retired now for more than a decade, and he is here to talk primarily about his trip to Paris that didn't go so well, but happy Independence Day to you.
Thank you.
You're dressed appropriately.
I had to. I'm proud to be an American.
I saw Leslie at Louis a few days ago, and he told me this story, and I thought this would be a good July 4th story, and here he is. And by the way, Louis was open this morning with Frenchie holding court, not closed on Independence Day, and we're glad that the show goes on here. And if you'd like to join the conversation, 877-217-5757. So you go to Paris, great place to visit, and things didn't go so well. What happened?
Not too well. First of all, the trip was a graduation gift for my son, who graduated in May with got a degree in computer science. And I'd promised him he had never been to Europe. I'd take him. Okay, so he planned the whole trip. 15 days, we went to 5 countries.
Just you and your son?
Just me and my son. And
nice bonding.
He loves trains. He had planned to ride on 22 train rides while we were in Europe. So we go to London first and spent 3 days, and everything went well. And then the 4th day, we took the Eurostar from London to Paris, which goes underneath the English Channel. And we arrived at La Gare du Nord, which is a huge train station in Paris. And within 30 minutes of being there, a gang had robbed us of everything we had, our passports, our money, our wallets, our credit cards. So there we were with nothing, no identity, no money in Paris, France. We instantly went up. They had a police substation on the 2nd floor. We went to it to report it. That was quite an experience there, because we ended up spending 4 hours in the police station. It was like a zoo, but they were doing their work, and one policeman especially was a big help. And in the four-hour period, he explained to me, we got free time to talk, how big a problem this is in Paris today. He said, I know y'all have a problem in America with the Mexican border, but he says our problem is greater, more severe than y'all's. And I think he's right. Because these criminals were not French citizens. They are illegal immigrants from North Africa who cross the border, and the French police don't know they're in the inland. And the policeman told me at least 100 a week come into Paris. They don't go into rural areas. They go to Paris, and they congregate. They operate in the train, the subways. Mm-hmm. And that's where we were robbed, not in the train. We got off the Eurostar, but then we had to take a subway to go to our hotel. There are three levels of the subway. The deeper you go, the more dangerous it is. And we were carrying two suitcases each, which gave away our idea of being tourists.
Yeah.
So we get down into the subway, and all this it happened too fast for me to realize it, but there were about six people involved in the gang that scammed us, five men and one woman. And as we got in, we had to stand up because we didn't have room to sit, and they came in one at a time and got around us. And two men were standing by the door, keeping the subway from moving by keeping the door from closing. And I had a weird feeling. I could see all this going on, but it didn't click in my mind. Hey, we're going to be robbed, because we had all our stuff. My son had bought a nice passport booklet where you could put your passport in it, and then your credit cards on the left and your money in the middle. It was all together. And it was in our pockets, left pocket. Well, needless to say, they got closer. It got crowded. And we saw the other subway going the other direction twice. And that entered my mind. Why is that one moving? And we're stuck here. And then a lady passed in front of me, passed her hand on my chest to see if I didn't have my money underneath my shirt, which I didn't. It was all in my pocket. And then a minute or so after that, they start running out of the subway. One, two, three, four. And then the two guys at the door left too. I told my son, I said, let's get out of here. We got out of the subway, but within 10 seconds, we felt our pocket was empty and everything was gone.
And we lost everything.
Lost everything. And that was on a Friday at 3 p.m.
How much cash did you have?
I had about $1,000 in cash in mine. He had about $100. Within 1 hour, they had bought over $4,000 worth of stuff on our credit cards.
Were they caught?
One was caught because they brought two or three into the station while we were there, and my son ID'd one of them. He said he was standing next to him. I couldn't honestly ID any of them, but I see two of them when I close my eyes because they were all – these weren't young people. These were people in that
– Dressed well?
30s, dressed very well. One man in a suit. Around the lady that passed in front of me had a dress on, and she, you know, dressed very well, very professional. But they operate – every day down there. So I asked the policeman, why don't y'all do something about it? He says, we want to, but we need more policemen, and we can't get more money from the government to hire more policemen.
Well, how did you get out of this mess?
Oh, Lord. we prayed a lot, one thing, okay? When he says we could finally leave, we did a report, and it took long because the other guy, there were two policemen working, couldn't speak English well. One could. And then that computer wouldn't work well. It took a long time to get all the – and they gave me a copy of the police report. He says, y'all can go. I said, no, we can't go. We don't have any money. How are we going to get to our hotel? Our hotel was about 2-3 miles away. We were going to ride the subway. The policeman was gracious enough to go and get us some tokens so we could get on the subway and ride it to our hotel. We got to the hotel. I opened my suitcase, and by the grace of God, I found I had put about 10 pounds from London that I had, the English currency.
Yes.
So that was about $10 worth. So it was about 7 at night. We had enough to go eat out. I said, we can't eat in a restaurant. We ended up eating at a Subway, getting a Subway and cutting it in half. That left us 2 pounds for Saturday. Now, that we couldn't do anything about our passport till Monday morning because the American Embassy didn't open till Monday. We instantly called my wife to send us some money, okay, Friday night. Anyway, we had problems with that. That didn't – at 10 o'clock in the morning, we went – they didn't have it at Western Union. That's too long a story to tell you. We didn't have any money. So we had a pass. We had paid everything prepaid. We had a pass to ride the bus around London Paris, I mean. On the, so I said, Paul, let's get on the bus. We'll come back at 4 o'clock. The place was going to close at 5 at the Western Union. So we rode around, and we saw – the stuff. Now, that was my fifth time to Paris. I had seen everything, and it's my last time. I'm not going back.
You're not?
No, because it's getting dangerous and dangerous, and I could see the difference. It had been 28 years since I had gone. I love France. My ancestors came from France in 1723, I'm a seventh-generation Louisianian, the first to grow up speaking French, but I'm not going back
speaking
to Paris.
English?
First to grow up speaking English. I mean, right. The countryside's okay, but Paris is too dangerous now. They need more policemen to patrol. Now, on the top level of the train station, they have policemen with automatic rifles walking.
Right.
Okay, because there's a lot of people there, but they don't have them down in the subways. And eventually, it's going to cut down on the tourism in Paris, and then when people start losing jobs, then they're going to start hollering to do something. But the biggest thing is that these are illegal immigrants, which they walk into France from either Spain or Italy. They can cross the border by walking in or driving all on a road. All the roads are not manned with immigrant with officers to control these people from coming in. And they are, the policeman told me in 10 years, he says, if nothing's done, they're going to take over the country.
Well, it was a bad experience for you. Hopefully this is not happening a whole lot, but you say it's happening
more
than
it
should.
The policeman told me it happens daily. And then the last thing that broke the straw, that broke the camel's back, on Monday morning when we go to the embassy, and I was there at 8 o'clock when it opened. I wanted to get my passport. Mm-hmm. We got our money at 5 o'clock on Saturday afternoon. We were down to zero money. If it wouldn't have come in, I don't know how would we have eaten.
What did you eat on Saturday?
We ate two bananas at 2 o'clock. I had two euros left. I bought two bananas from a guy near the Eiffel Tower. That's what we ate on Saturday.
That was your Saturday
Saturday meal
feast
in Paris, France. Right, right.
A movable feast, as Ernest Hemingway called it.
That's right. But when the money came in, we went at 8 o'clock to the embassy, my son and I, and they opened the door. And I told my son, I said, Paul, when we get in the embassy ground, that's American soil. That's the safest place in France for us. Mm-hmm. So they opened the gates right at 8. That was about 10 in line. We second. They check you like you could go in an airplane. You know, they have the security there and then the wards to check you. They were checking the man ahead of me. I dropped my police report. I bent down to get it. He was coming up between the man's leg between me and hit me on my head, and the blood just spurted down my face. I thought I was going to have to go to the hospital. Got injured in, but this was an accident now, not deliberately, but got injured
you
on the American grounds.
Bad trip.
Bad trip in Paris. We left France and we went to one of the most safest countries in Europe, Switzerland, because they control their borders.
So you're not going back to France?
Not to Paris. I might go to Lyon or other places in France, but not Paris. Uh-uh.
And this from a man who is the pride of Bordelonville.
Well, I'm a proud French American, but it's gotten out of control, and the policeman's the one told me the background about how bad it's gotten. And he says every week 100 more additional of these people, these gangs members, come into Paris.
I don't guess you got your cash back.
No, I didn't. Yeah. I lost my cash.
Well, hopefully you didn't lose I think it's good you didn't lose your life or limb. People probably, my guess is that they were armed.
Probably so. We did not see any armed, but I bet out of the six, one had a gun or a knife or something to protect himself if it got the worst. So, thank God for
that. And this all happened, Leslie, in
it happened
30 seconds?
Well, no, we were on the subway for about 10 minutes. It happened gradually, but the subway wouldn't leave.
Gotcha.
We were stalled. That was the big thing.
Well, we're glad you're back home.
I'm glad,
thank
too.
You for telling your story on the 4th of July.
Okay, thank you. And Bastille Day is July 14th. I'll still celebrate Bastille Day.
God bless
but
you.
But France has to do something to stop the problem.
This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. And we're visiting now with Lee Reich. He is a Ph.D. in horticulture and author of Weedless Gardening, the Pruning Book, Landscaping with Fruit, and other books. And his latest is The Ever Curious Gardener, Using a Little Natural Science for a Much Better Garden. And good morning to you, Lee Reich.
Good morning. Nice to be here.
Now, this is described as an irreverent romp through the natural science of plants and soil. You don't always take it so seriously, do you?
No, there's so much serious stuff going on in the world. Why not take this seriously?
Well, people often do take their garden seriously, maybe more seriously than anything else in their lives. This is a passion that many people have and take great delight and have extreme passion for.
Yeah, well, I should say, you know, as I said that, I realized that I guess I'm very serious about my garden, but a lighter side, too, and a positive side, since I'm working with nature, and I always try and emulate Mother Nature. Even when things go wrong, I find it sort of interesting and enjoyable.
What are some of the areas where things do often go wrong?
Well, for instance, I grow figs, which you might find hard to believe since I'm up in the New York's Hudson Valley. But I grow figs in a greenhouse, and I really enjoy the fresh figs. And I grew them. I've grown them for many years in the greenhouse. And then a couple of years ago, I started getting mealybugs on my figs, just in the greenhouse. I grow some in pots outside, and I don't get them. But I tried dormant oil sprays. I tried a toothbrush and alcohol to try and scrub the plants down. And basically, I tried a lot of stuff, and it took a lot of time. And nothing was working. And then finally, last year, I bought some natural predators that were specific against the fig. Actually, it wasn't really bug, it's scale, which is closely related. Fig scale insects. And they were quite effective and quite expensive. So I figured that my figs were costing me about $1 each then. I had two releases in the greenhouse of predators. They cost $80 each time. $160, and I figured that's about how many figs I got from the greenhouse. But then this year I decided that why would I have them outside? Not have them outside, but always have them inside. So I thought maybe it's, you know, some of the environment, and maybe if I just sprayed them down with water regularly, that would change the environment to more like outside, because they never get rained on in the greenhouse. Mm-hmm. And also it might knock some off. And I've been doing that for about 2 months. I have not seen scale insects since. So I'm not 100% saying it's because of what I did, because there's a lot of things that happen in the garden that gardeners attribute to their actions that are not necessarily due to their actions. So I'm not saying 100%, but so far it's been working. I guess in a few years, more experience, I'll know if this really did work.
You say even without squealing like hungry pigs, your plants can tell you if they're hungry. How does that happen?
They put out signs mostly on their signals on their leaves. First of all, if the plant's not growing well, that could be a sign that they're hungry for some nutrient. It also could be something else. But also, there could be various leaf symptoms that could show that, for instance, if a plant is deficient in nitrogen, it typically the oldest leaves will start to yellow, just generally yellow first. And the reason for this is because the nitrogen can be reapportioned within the plant, so it goes from the oldest leaves to feed the youngest leaves. And then eventually, if the plant doesn't have enough nitrogen, they'll all turn yellow. And because nitrogen is one component of chlorophyll, which makes green, the green color of leaves, if you don't have enough nitrogen, when those old leaves lose nitrogen, they turn pale. So that's one symptom. So basically, you can look at the leaves of your plant, and if something's awry nutritionally, the leaves can tell you pretty specifically what it is. But as I said, there could be sometimes insects or diseases can affect that also, or sometimes environmental conditions or soil conditions mm-hmm. can affect nutrient availability. For instance, that iron deficiency I mentioned, often on, say, blueberries, people get that, and it's not a sign that even though the leaves will show iron deficiency, it's not because there's not enough iron in the soil, there is enough iron, but because the pH, the soil acidity, is not correct. And if the soil acidity is not correct, the iron actually can't be taken up by the plant. So that's just some of the ways they show you. But you have to be careful, as I said, not to, you know, people sometimes learn, you know, about my favorite example is a disease called verticillium wilt, which, you know, attacks a lot of plants, but, you know, I've never had it. But it has a ring to it, a really ominous ring to it. So, you know, you see something wrong with your plant and say, oh, it must be verticillium wilt. But, you know, it can be a lot of things.
What should we be aware of when we're purchasing a packet of seeds?
Well, fortunately, there's certain legalities that make you know, seeds have to have a certain germination rate. They have it stamped on the packet, usually how old the seeds are. So, you know, these are things you want. You want the seeds to be viable, or you want to know how viable they are. You want to know how old they are, because seeds are actually alive, even though they look like specks of sand sometimes, depending on how big they are. So they are alive, and they do get old, and they do eventually lose their vitality and won't germinate. So you want how old they are. You want it to be labeled, of course, correctly as to what it is. But I think you know, you're doing pretty well. If you look at a packet of seeds, it will be what's in there. And then, you know, as far as varieties, if you're interested in growing, say, heirloom plants, if it's a hybrid variety, it's not an heirloom. That's something to know. And then you can look at characteristics of the seeds generally, besides the specific variety. For instance, with tomatoes, there's what are called determinate and indeterminate tomatoes. And determinate tomatoes just keep growing longer and longer and higher along one main stem. And side shoots can do it also. Where determinate tomatoes, the length of a stem is determined. The stem ends in a flower, and then it only grows by branching. And this is more than just something to tell you how to train the plant if you're going to train it. Like, you can't stake determinate tomatoes, mm-hmm. or you'll just end up with a single stem with a flower and fruits on top of it. And the other thing is that indeterminate tomatoes have a higher leaf-to-fruit ratio, so they actually taste better. So I never grow determinate tomatoes. I only grow indeterminate tomatoes. Flavor is the main thing I'm interested in.
And you are a proponent of crop rotation.
Oh, yeah. I think it's more than just a proponent. I think this is a recognized good agricultural practice, something that's been practiced for eons, since agriculture first began. Not that it's always done on a commercial scale due to economic considerations, but for anybody that doesn't know what that is, that's growing crops in different places so that each year you don't plant them too soon again in the same place just because diseases and insects might build up in the soil, so you want to plant them somewhere else to starve out any pest problems. And so in my garden, I have my garden's in beds. And what I do is every year I move all the beds. So there's a main path up the middle, then beds coming off either side. So each bed, I plant what was planted this year, and next year in that bed I'll plant, just move that crop one bed up. Everything gets moved around the garden, and nothing gets planted in the same place more than 2 years in a row. And mm-hmm. it's just one of many ways to reduce the potential pest problems. It won't 100% say you won't get any pests, but you do all these little things to reduce the potential, and that's one of them, and it's easy. And the other thing that crop rotation is, besides pest problems, is different nutrients remove different plants remove different nutrients from the soil. Like root crops remove a lot of potassium from the soil. Leafy crops remove a lot of nitrogen. So by rotating the crops, you keep what's removed from the soil in balance, so you don't get a buildup of one nutrient or a deficiency of another.
Lastly, Lee, you say the dead language of Latin can make us better gardeners. How can that happen?
Well, it tells you how plants are related. Basically, plants have been grouped into families just like humans and other animals are. And when you know what family your plants are in, this actually helps, once again, prevent insects and pest problems, because not only what I mentioned previously about crop rotation, that you don't want to plant the same, say you don't want to plant tomato in the same bed every year, you also don't want to plant anything in the tomato family, which is really the deadly nightshade family, Solanaceae. So, and that includes tomatoes, peppers, potatoes, eggplants. So you would not plant, so this year, the bed that I planted tomatoes, I will not plant peppers, potatoes or eggplants in that same bed. So the whole, anything in the family gets rotated to a new bed each year also. So that's one way. Also, it's sort of interesting if you don't know, if you just even look wandering through a field or through the woods and you don't know what a plant is, often you can look at the flower structure generally and say, oh, that's a plant in the carrot family, which is very easy to identify if you've ever seen Queen Anne's lace, which is basically the same genus and species as carrot also. But the way the flowers are arranged, like an umbrella, and that's why the plant family is botanically called the Umbellifera family, but it can be more commonly known as the carrot family. And so carrots in that family, dill is in that family, parsnip is in that family, yarrow is in that family. And if you're familiar with any of these plants, you can see they all have the same type of flower head. And so this is good for identifying the plants, but also a crop rotation.
The book is The Ever Curious Gardener from Lee Reich, and we thank you for joining us today, Lee, joining us from
his
farm in New Paltz, New York. It's been a pleasure. Congratulations.
And happy 4th.
Hope you have a great Independence Day, and tomorrow we'll be talking about President Trump's announcement come Monday for his nomination to the U.S. Supreme Court. Until then, for Ali Baltazar, I'm Jim Inkster. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org.